From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It might be a cliche to say last week was unlike any other in recent memory, but sometimes cliches are true. Two deadly explosions near the finish line of Boston's world-famous marathon kicked off an intense and often harrowing week filled with horror and heroism, city lockdowns, and a dramatic capture of suspect number two. All of it playing out in front of television, radio, newspapers, and the web. There's a familiar pattern that's developed as to how the media covers high-profile tragedies like the bombings in Boston, and the coverage last week is prompting some difficult questions this week for media watchers. Why did so many early reports about the bombings turn out to be way off base? Is wall-to-wall news coverage too much news coverage or not? How is social media changing how we gather information and learn about a major breaking news story? Today on The Exchange, crisis coverage in real time, how news organizations handle breaking stories, and what we can learn from Boston. And we'd like to hear from you. How do you follow the news from Boston over the past week? What concerned or impressed you about that coverage? What about the role of social media? Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or send a question or comment through The Exchange Facebook page. We have a full panel of guests with us for the hour. Paul Fahey is media reporter for The Washington Post. Paul, it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks very much, Brady.
Adam Schweigert is with us. He's director of technology with the Investigative News Network, where he's responsible for leading the organization's technology-related efforts. Adam, it's great to talk with you as well. Adam, are you there?
Thank you.
Oh, great. So no problem. And Bob Thompson is with us, founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University, where he's also trustee professor of television and popular culture at the S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications. And Bob Thompson, nice to have you back on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start with a quote from an article on Slate.com. Writer Farhad Manju summed up the week of coverage this way. He said, and I'll quote, he said, "Breaking news is broken. Don't watch cable news. Shut off Twitter. You'd be better off cleaning your gutters." Is that fair, do you think, Paul Fahey? Is breaking news broken?
Sure, and it pretty much always has been. We just know more about the breaking news now. We have many more sources of breaking news, which isn't always news. But, you know, you can go back to any of these big breaking stories and find misreporting, bad reporting, inaccurate reporting. That's nothing new. What is new is the ability to access that reporting. You can access many different sources and see how badly they are doing. And they always do badly because it's chaotic, it's people don't know, and, you know, we're all trying, including the sources, are trying to sort things out.
Bob Thompson, I wanted to get your reaction as well. Is it simply that there's no easy way to get it always right in the midst of a chaotic news situation?
Well, I think it's the thing is that when we're watching breaking news, we are watching the process of gathering news and getting information. It's not like a reporter has gone out and gotten the information, and then they've gotten their confirmations, and then they've had a meeting with their editors, and then finally we get it. We're watching it as it's being gathered. And, of course, anybody who's ever done reporting or done research, for that matter, knows you go down a bunch of different directions. Some of them don't turn out to be correct, but we see all that. That's all done in front of us. And as we just pointed out, this is nothing new. Even when newspapers were doing extra editions, they occasionally would rush to print with, headlines like Dewey defeats Truman. When the Kennedy assassination news first broke on television, there were reports of a quote-unquote dark-skinned assailant, which turned out, of course, not to be true. The 2000 election, when Florida was called and then retracted and then called again, and of course it was weeks before we found out what was going on. I remember the early mornings of September 11th, somebody reporting that somebody had said they saw a missile hit one of the buildings. The attacks on the Washington Mall that weren't true. And then, of course, we followed a story like the bubble boy for the good portion of the day, and that turned out to be absolutely nothing.
And I remember, in fact, in the 9/11 attacks, living in Illinois at the time, that there were early reports that what was then called the Sears Tower was also potentially an attack, and that turned out not to be true. Adam Schweigert, you and I both spend a lot of time on social media, and as Paul Fahrey mentioned, that's one of the new ways where you can access the information, whether it's accurate or not. How did the news about Boston that you saw play out, and was it more accurate or about the same compared to, say, previous breaking news stories over the past few years?
Yeah, I think it was about the same. I mean, you always sort of see the earliest news comes from all over the place, but then eventually, once like mainstream like media like, picks up a story, you see, I think, a lot of echoing what's actually said on air. So I don't think it really like changes all that much. I think the first 5 minutes of the story, the sort of chaotic, the like mess of the early updates, the we don't actually like know much, but there's a couple of like photos spreading like rapidly. I think that's a different thing. And it is, I think, as I think Paul said, you see the process unfold in a way that a year ago, 5 years ago, I don't think you saw as much. And I think with each new breaking news event, you see more and more of that process. And I don't know if it's getting better or if it's actually getting worse. I think we're at a stage where we're sort of learning how to do this well, and I think the media is also figuring out there's a role that I think journalists can play in sort of filtering and actually helping to sort of debunk the sort of bad information, like pressing back on the early citizen stuff that's actually coming out. So there is a role for us, I think, there too.
What I've seen too, and I'll put this to you, Paul, is that sort of shaking out process in the early going, where you've seen people not only trying to gather the information that they have, but also being a little more forthright about debunking the information that they now know to be untrue. And that's something that I've seen develop, especially in the past week, but a little bit as well in a few past incidents, too.
That's right. And, you know, there are often caveats in the reporting you'll see, too, is like, we have not confirmed this, a kind of transparency in terms of what we know for sure and what we think we know. That is a very good development because, you know, often reporters will state as if handed down from God the truth, things that they don't really know for sure, or that they're getting from secondhand sources or not very good sources. But just to follow up on one point, is it getting worse? And I believe it is getting worse for the simple reason that there is no media per se anymore. Everyone is the media, and everyone reports to a certain extent. And that's what Twitter is. That's what Facebook is. Everybody has a platform. Everyone can broadcast what they know or what they think they know. So this kind of fire hose of information creates its own uncertainty and its own obfuscation.
And in a case like that, then, Bob Thompson, is self-correcting going to be enough? Or is there simply a case where we have to try and assume that for a while we're going to hear things that aren't correct?
Well, I think we definitely have to make that assumption. I think for some time now, people it's become obvious that while you're getting these breaking news stories, when something is interrupting all of the regular schedule, when something is going down as happened in Boston, that you just have to assume that a lot of what you're going to see may turn out not to be true. And, you know, this would be the case in any. I don't think there's any way of, you know, fixing this insofar as if we're going to cover breaking news as it's happening, the mistakes are going to constantly be made. If you took a really responsible historian, they go down and they do their research and they follow certain leads, and then they find certain sources are bad, and then they rewrite it and all of that. If you were to put a camera on that historian as he or she were doing their research, you would then get all that stuff. There'd be all that information they'd find, and then they'd have to correct them and all the rest of it. That's what's happening here is we are, as I said before, watching the process as it happens, and that's invariably going to lead to you get to the truth oftentimes by following paths that aren't true. I will say this. I think probably at no other time have we been more in need of good, professional, ethical media institutions, because we've now, as has been pointed out, we've got all of these people who have access to international distribution system via the internet. There's this almost infinity of information coming out, and the idea of organizations who, with skills and professionally, are able to sort of sift through that all are needed perhaps more than ever before. Yet those same organizations are playing this game of getting stuff out as soon as possible and all the rest of it. And consequently, we get even places like CNN and AP reporting things that turn out to not be true. By the way, when the smoke clears in these big stories, by and large, the correct information gets out. You just have to figure that that's going to take a while.
Well, today on The Exchange, crisis coverage in real time. Last week's bombings in Boston kept many glued to the news and to social media, but sometimes getting the latest means getting it wrong. Others say such errors are nothing new and that there are definite pluses to the proliferation of information. We're talking with three media watchers about the issues coming up as in that shaking out process of a breaking news story, and we'd like to get your thoughts into the mix as well. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, that's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a question or comment to the Exchange Facebook page. Gentlemen, we're going to take a short break right now, but when we come back, we'll have more questions about the way that this process unfolded. And I'd like to ask you each about the visual aspect of that, especially some of the very painful and graphic photos that came out throughout the course of last week. That's all coming up when The Exchange continues. Stay with us.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And you can take NHPR with you wherever you go with the NHPR app, available for Apple and Android devices. It lets you stream NHPR and Classical NH 24/7, download all of our podcasts, and receive news updates throughout the day. And it keeps you updated on all the discounts you're entitled to with your NHPR member card. Download the NHPR app today. More on the crisis coverage in real time on The Exchange, and at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, the latest developments in the case against the Boston bombers. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Dr. William Sutherland of Sports Medicine, Atlantic Orthopedics at Portsmouth and York, whose recent public lecture on back and leg pain is available online at smao.org. And the Dairyfield School, a 6th to 12th grade a day school, inspiring students to find their passion for academics, athletics, and the arts. Open house May 2nd, online at dairyfield.org/visit. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Today on The Exchange, how the media handles an ongoing crisis. If getting the latest means getting it wrong, are we okay with that? We'd like to hear from you. Join us at 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment to our Facebook page. Joining us for the hour is Paul Farhi, media reporter at The Washington Post, Adam Schweigert, director of technology with the Investigative News Network, and Bob Thompson, who teaches at Syracuse University. We were talking just before the break about the idea that in the early moments after a big breaking news story, there's going to be a lot of misinformation floating around, and each of you have been saying that the important thing is to correct that. I wanted to share an email we got from Suzanne in Dummerston, Vermont, She said that she was in the Boston area Thursday and Friday, 5 minutes outside the lockdown area. She says, I cautiously went about my business and stayed tuned to WGBH radio, one of the local Boston public radio stations. She says they tried to stay careful, accurate, intelligent, and unhyped. At one point when one host started to report on a rumor that had been disproven, the other host said, and she's paraphrasing, wait a minute, that one's been found to be not true. And then she says they actually refrained from reporting that rumor. In general, Suzanne writes, the 24/7 news cycle, especially on TV, has become more destructive than instructive. But of course, this is a very complex issue. Paul Farhi, you wrote about this, that maybe as we start to get used to the idea that these pieces of misinformation come out in a breaking story, that they might make less of a difference now than in the past. But you also wrote that there's one big exception. And we heard at one point that some news organizations said authorities were seeking a dark-skinned suspect. And you said the public forgives some mistakes, maybe not ones where race is involved. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yes, that's one of the cases that came out of Boston that CNN was reporting, that a suspect, a dark-skinned individual, was suspected. I think people feel that that adds little to the discussion, gives the public no extra information, and just kind of inflames a certain kind of racist tendency. It's part and parcel with the idea that you put out information that's incorrect and never actually correct that information. But this is the subcategory of eyebrow-raising, sort of racist, and not helpful information. Because what could we do with information that says the suspect is dark-skinned? It's like saying the suspect is male. It adds very little to the mix. This is another point that's worth bringing out here, which is what I wrote about as well, that we do have more misinformation around because we have more sources of information, but we also have a better and faster mechanism for correcting that information. CNN got some stuff wrong. CNN also corrected it within perhaps 10 minutes, and that mistake didn't last very long because CNN was bombarded with sources saying, you are wrong and you need to correct, and in fact, CNN did correct it, as well as the AP and Fox News and others. So, as much as we get stuff wrong, we get it right much faster as well.
One of the other big sources of targets of criticism last week, Adam, was the New York Post, which famously posted or published that cover depicting two people under the headline "Bag Men," two people who were cleared by authorities seemingly before the ink on the newspaper was dry, and there was a huge backlash on social media about that cover.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think you saw, again, a lot of the sort of crowdsourced, manhunt to actually try to find the suspects. Reddit got involved. We had a number of other online forums involved in actually finding and just going through all the photos and trying to find, possible suspects. And of course, they didn't, right? There was no actual movement on that until the sort of official photos actually came out. So I think the sort of racist question, right? Of let's not try to find every single dark-skinned person that has a bag on in a photo, right? That doesn't really help anything. And I think as a sort of mainstream media, there's a role there that we can actually play in not furthering some of those more sort of negative things.
Let's take a call from one of our listeners. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Arnie is calling from Concord. Hi, Arnie. You're on the exchange.
Morning, Brady. Good morning, everybody. 2 days after the Marathon bombing, there was a massive explosion in West Texas at a fertilizer factory that led to the death of 13 people. Injuries to about 200, destroyed a block, 50 homes, an apartment building. In a sense, while you don't want to kind of do a mathematical comparison, in a sense, of people's lives being destroyed. But in a sense, this was a comparable event that has not gotten the type of obsessive media coverage that the Boston situation has gotten.
It's an incredibly important question. Thank you, Arnie, for that call. And I'll ask you, Bob Thompson, a huge, huge story coming out of Texas in the same week that these bombings took place in Boston. And yet much of the breaking coverage focused almost exclusively on Boston, with occasional references to what was going on in the town of West Texas. Not necessarily comparable coverage at all. And at the same time, a big earthquake in China and some other news coming out at the same time. Why so much coverage in this one direction, do you think?
Yeah, well, the trajectory of how that explosion in West Texas was covered was really fascinating, because you're right, the story was breaking. I think Matt Lauer was sent down there for the Today Show, and everybody was ready to give that the full breaking news coverage. And then, of course, the Boston Marathon thing happened, and suddenly West Texas not disappeared, but it certainly was put on the back burner. And then it's interesting, after the final arrest was made right outside of Boston, all of a sudden West Texas got put back up again. We started seeing it again. I mean, I think this is a simple matter of that we don't cover stories according to the simple arithmetic of casualties. I suppose one way you could say what story is number one, two, three, and four is how many people died. That would be one way you could rationally do it. But that isn't how it's done. For example, when lots and lots and lots of people die in an earthquake in another country, it often doesn't get nearly the coverage that when one teenage woman is missing in this country. I know this sounds callous, and I don't mean it to, and I don't mean to be being glib about it, but terrorism as a narrative trumps what appears to be an accident. There was an explosion with casualties in West, and then you've not only got something that's suspected of being terrorism, but one of the people is still at large, and it takes place in a big city like Boston, on a big iconic event like the marathon. I mean, the factors of this, and again, I don't mean to be glib about this, but the screenplay factors in this Boston story just kept piling up, and that's what they went for, and I don't think that's ever going to change.
Paul Farhi, since we're talking now about this, we've talked about the quality of the news coverage, but let's talk about the quantity a bit. It felt like there was an earlier push to go to the wall-to-wall breaking news coverage, and to stay with that rather than to, say, provide periodic updates. Maybe I'm imagining that, or is there a push now where news organizations are going to stay with one big story, even if there are other big stories happening at the same time?
Well, I mean, part of that was driven by some of the factors that Bob was just describing. You know, you have a very large metropolitan area, you have a public safety issue, you have the iconic event, you have a suspect on the loose. I mean, you know, apart from the sensation value of it, if you will, there's also the actual true safety of the public. And as it turns out, it appears that these guys had some other plans, or at least the means to carry out other destructive acts. So it's not unjustified to interrupt the game shows and the talk shows in the morning and the afternoon to bring you that story. There's also tremendous public interest in the story itself. And, you know, comparing it to the West Texas thing, which is not such a great way to go about it, but, you know, this is news you can use to a certain extent. The West Texas thing is literally an isolated, it appears, industrial accident. Most people don't live next door to a fertilizer plant. This is unlikely to happen to them. However, everybody thinks, wrongly or rightly, that they could be the victim of terrorism. And besides that, they're concerned about the people in Boston, the ongoing threat. So that kind of coverage is justified by simple public interest and by the potential for something else happening.
Adam Schweigert, something that I noticed happening across the web was this feeling of propriety, where it was almost seen as inappropriate to talk about anything else other than Boston. I mean, the first thing that you hear in Twitter circles, for example, when a breaking news story happens, is that people say, well, anyone who has pre-scheduled any posts that are going to go out on Twitter or Facebook, cancel those now because you don't want something about the sale at your shop to come out when there's, you know, word of a bombing in Boston. How does that change the feeling when, you know, you almost can't talk about something, but you can't not talk about it either?
Yeah. And so I think it becomes very sort of immersive, right? It's like Twitter is actually like a really good like tool for having like a real time a conversation about an event, right? So you see it like for things like the Super Bowl, and you now see it like for these like big sort of breaking news events, and it's the sort of community where everyone like gets, you know, so together in the same like place and sort of talking about like one thing. So it builds a sense of community, but I think it also does exclude. It makes it hard if there are sort of like three active, you know, like major stories. I think you can hardly like follow each one, right? Because there's like so much. There's like so much noise, even in just one story. That like three of them stacked, you end up with like so much noise. It's hard to actually figure out what's what. And I think that's also like becoming a big issue. It sort of breeds the same sort of thing that I think like 24-hour like news does, like where you know play the same thing over and over again on a loop, right? It's like that same idea, except in an online space.
The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Bob Thompson, Adam mentioned that idea of the 24/7 news cycle and the loop of coverage, and I wanted to ask you about some of that coverage, both in terms of the video that came out of Boston and the photos that were everywhere. And of course, in New Hampshire, there's a real strong connection because one of the people in the most famous photos has ties to this state. His father lives here in Concord. And I was struck, of course, by some of the graphic nature of these photos, but also how often I was running into them wherever I turned, whether it was to check news on cable or to simply check my Facebook feed. Is there a more of an emphasis now to try and put out the most striking photo, even if it happens to be graphic?
Well, I think that process started sometime in the 19th century when photography developed. I mean, the idea that you could get a picture. I mean, let's face it, even before we had photography, we used to send newspapers, would send illustrators to the, you know, battlefront and to various places so that we could get pictures, even though we couldn't get them from some objective process like photography. So anybody who's, you know, followed local news and anything, you know, if it's a fire, if it's something that moves, the pictures are more compelling. Now, in this country, we've had a real sort of strange sense of part of us wants the most sensational picture possible, but the other half complains that this is too graphic, it shouldn't be being shown in our living rooms. And that argument, I think, gets very odd and paradoxical at times. We live in a time when we can actually get pictures. If you're going to tell a story about an explosion, part of that story is the fact that these explosions create horrible results. If you're going to cover a war, part of covering a war is that bodies will be killed. I'm sometimes a little bothered by how we're worried that we're going to offend people with these pictures. A bomb blew up in the middle of a metropolitan area where thousands of people were gathered. One of the central things of that story is that is a horrible event that took all kinds of made all kinds of injuries and all the rest of it. If you're covering the story at all, the idea of pulling back on that imagery strikes me as a little strange.
Well,
and I think most of the
editing,
television,
Bob. I mean, we do
the
that
internet,
all the,
you could see anything.
We do that all
most
the time.
Most of the television was, I think, shockingly restrained in what they show. They're telling the story about this big explosion, and for a good portion on that first day, we were getting stills on TV when there certainly were plenty of images that weren't stills.
But you were saying, Paul, that you said self-editing, that's something we do all the time.
Sure, that's what the media does. I mean, it selects for your consumption the images, the words that it thinks are acceptable to you, and we do this all the time. I mean, covering the war, you will never see a body of an American soldier. It's taboo in American newsrooms. That just doesn't happen. And there's lots of debates that go on as just how bloody we want to present an event like this, and how much the images we've got. Tons and tons of those images now. There were hundreds, maybe thousands of people with cameras taking those pictures. They're all available in one form or another. And that's what the media does. It screens out those things that are just too much for you to take. And everybody has a different judgment about what's acceptable. And in weird, perverse cases, you have the incident like at the New York Daily News, which had a very bloody picture, and it was of an injury in which a man's leg was blown off, and you could certainly see this, and they photoshopped it, so you couldn't quite see the traumatic injury that this man suffered, and they presented that picture photoshopped that way. That's not kosher. We don't do that. But we do always, try to filter these things for public consumption.
And Adam, another factor that rolls into this too is that even if a news organization doesn't intend a photo to go to be seen everywhere, the fact that someone could find it on the web and share it means that it could go viral, as they say, even if there is that tendency in a news organization to try and select particular images.
Yes, exactly. So I was going to say that I think there's also pressure now on more sort of mainstream outlets too, as a result of the fact that the photos are actually shared online widely. And I think that this notion of if it's not on CNN or not in the paper, I'm actually going to see it anyway. I've seen, it's bloodier photos like leading like New York Times and .com in the last couple of these incidents than I think you would have seen, before. And I don't think it's necessarily like a sensationalism thing. I think it's also the fear of just missing out, of like not having like that iconic photo that everyone's already seen anyway.
This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. We're talking about crisis coverage in real time in the aftermath of the bombings at the Boston Marathon. We're about to come up to a short break. When we come back, we'll hear more from our three panelists, and we'll also take more calls and hear more emails. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Stay with us. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and the NEEF Network organizations working with the New Hampshire Department of Education to increase the college aspirations of local students at iamcollegebound.org. And from People's United Bank, offering a full line of services to help individuals, businesses, and communities succeed. People's United Bank would know how can do. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
I'm Anna Moskoff, NHPR's Major Gifts Officer. Your current and future support is the key to sustaining NHPR for the next generation of listeners, which is why we're excited to announce that you can create a charitable gift annuity with NHPR. It's a wonderful way to support a valuable service to the state while providing an additional source of income in your retirement. To learn more about charitable gift annuities, visit our support page at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Tomorrow on The Exchange, checking in on New Hampshire's dropout rate. Email us your questions ahead of the show at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9 for The Exchange. Today on the program, crisis coverage in real time. Last week's bombings in Boston kept many glued to the news and social media, but sometimes getting the latest means getting it wrong. We're talking with Paul Farhi, media reporter at The Washington Post, Adam Schweigert, director of technology with the Investigative News Network, and Bob Thompson of Syracuse University. And let's hear now from some of our listeners. The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Lucy is calling from Hampton. Hi, Lucy. You're on the Exchange.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Go ahead with your question.
Well, my question is, and it's more of a concern rather, is when a large event and a very scary and you know, rightfully so, shocking event happens, like the bombings in Boston, we do need to be aware of what's going on. But sometimes it seems as though the media glamorizes it. You turn on the news and there's new graphics and a new song to go with it. And it seems almost as if we're watching a movie unfold. And not all the pieces are correct. Not all the information is accurate. And I wonder, is it necessary to do this? Is it respectful to do this? It creates sort of a heightened fear level. And I want to hear what's happening, and I want to know when it's done. You know, I want to know the end result, but I don't want to hear, oh, they've moved 2 inches. Oops, look at that. Now they're backing away. I think it almost keeps us all at a heightened level of fear, and I just wonder if it's necessary to do that. Is it respectful?
Lots of thoughtful questions there, Lucy. Thanks for the call. Paul Fari, I'll start with you. What's your reaction to that? Is there a certain amount of glamorizing going on? And if so, what does that say?
Well, I mean, in some sense, we enhance the news. You have graphics. You have sometimes music added, as she points out. You know, this is like production values, and it does seem unnecessary to me. But, you know, it's part of making the news more palatable. It's part of making the news more watchable. It's what, you know, newspapers and TV and radio and everybody else has always done. You package the news a certain way. It doesn't necessarily have to be offensive, and it doesn't necessarily have to raise fear. It sometimes just frames the story better. But, you know, there's legitimate argument about whether you're going too far.
Bob Thompson, we got an email question from Karina who says, has the media ever considered how the 24/7 news coverage has an impact on people's psyche in perhaps an unhealthy or negative way? She says, I would argue an unnecessary way. It's kind of tying out in with what Lucy was asking.
Right. Well, if the question is it necessary? The answer is clearly no. I mean, it's not like, you know, news doesn't happen like the law of gravity happens. People make this, they create it, they make decisions. So it isn't necessary. And the psyche issue, I think some people do get onto this breaking story. If they've got the ability, they can sometimes park themselves in front of this coverage, and it can really sort of take you into a completely different psychic state. That, of course, happened to many, many people on September 11th. I remember after about 12 hours of watching Columbine coverage, I felt some of this myself. But let's remember, we call these things news stories. Things happen in actual space and time, and then they are told, and in telling them, one uses all kinds of dramaturgical choices. And now, of course, that includes audio and visual and music and fancy graphics and all of that kind of thing. I mean, the only people who actually experienced the events of these stories were the people that were there. After that, it all becomes a translation, and we just now happen to have all kinds of sophisticated types of things. I wouldn't call it glamorized so much as I'd call it that these stories are tarted up.
Lucy, thanks so much for your call, and Karina, thanks for sharing your thoughts as well. Let's hear next from Ryan, who is calling from Dover. Hi, Ryan, you're on the Exchange.
Hi, thanks for having me. This is a great topic, and you know, I just kind of going off of what the last caller asked and what the guest just talked about, isn't there an ethical obligation at some point where, yes, we're retelling a story or telling a story in real time and it's news, but, I mean, what about when that crosses the line to, you know, we're completely bombarded and surrounded by images and it's maybe bad for children and it's maybe causing more problems and the kind of like creating copycat people that want to do this in the future? Or, you know, what regulations, not regulations, but, you know, aren't there ethical questions that the media has to kind of come up with to police themselves, and can they have their own consequences, sort of?
Great questions. Thank you. Thank you, Ryan. And I'll pose that to Adam Schweigert. It used to be that if you were simply overwhelmed by a story, that you could turn it off. But if every channel, or at least many channels, are now going to the breaking coverage, it's more and more difficult to do that. And at the same time, if you're turning into social media, it's hard to avoid it if your friends are still talking about it.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you can still absolutely unplug and, you know, turn it off and go for a walk or read a book, right? And I think that the news organizations would say that they actually, like, have an obligation to actually be there, like, for the people who haven't been following along. So I think there are like, some things the sort of media can do to make it a little less, engrossing, although that's bad for obviously ratings. But I think there are some things we can do, and I think there are some other, like, complicated ethical issues there. But I think the answer is that as like a consumer, you can always just turn it off if you want. So you have to make that choice.
Again, Ryan, thank you so much for that call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Paul Fahey, what the last few callers and emailers have been touching on is the idea that in a crisis, media is a public service, not simply just an organization or a business, but is serving the public in a very important and essential way. And I wanted to ask you about the dynamic between news organizations and public safety officials during a crisis. Certainly, journalists don't want to put the public at risk, and there were times when the FBI was making pointed statements about false media reports, saying you are maybe harming our investigation. At the same time, though, you don't want organizations to always take statements from officials at face value. So where do you draw that line?
Well, let me say, first of all, the media did do a public service in this case. It kept people, generally speaking, quite well aware of what the threats were, the nature of them, the location of them. And, in fact, the law enforcement officials were quite praiseworthy of the media and in terms of the assistance that they got from the media in getting the word out. So, yes, that is in something that the media should be praised for. I mean, we cover the news. We're not interested in having people be harmed. We're actually interested in the opposite. We're part of this community and part of every community, and we have basically the same interests as the people of that community. I don't think it's all about sensation. I think there are real practical issues involved. I mean, think of any weather emergency. The information you get from the media is vital to your public safety, and we've done this routinely for decades and decades. We don't expect praise for it. It's just part of the job of what we do. But that's the kind of information that's useful to society, and it's not harmful. I would question what information is harmful, and perhaps we intensify a prejudice, perhaps we falsely accuse people, but that's by far the minority, and often is called out for being the exception to what is essentially very responsible behavior by the media.
Let's hear from another one of our listeners. Peter is calling from Winchester. Hi, Peter. You're on the exchange.
Hi. Good morning. Very interesting topic. My son is a journalist in the Boston area, and we were talking about exactly this thing just a couple of days ago. I had a specific reference I wanted to make. At some point, there was talk of a third suspect having been arrested, and at some point, this became actually pretty detailed. There was a description of how the police had forced this suspect to disrobe entirely to prove that they weren't carrying some kind of vest. And then this story just seemed to evaporate. There was no retraction, there was no correction, there was no verification, or even yet whether this person is still in custody. And I think this is the kind of thing you're talking about. Was this a real story or wasn't it?
It's a great question, Peter, and I remember hearing those same reports as well. Bob Thompson, as part of that shaking out process that we've been talking about throughout the course of the hour, Is there a way in which news organizations can then, say, tie up the loose ends rather than simply going off to report on what we know and maybe continually do a job of putting out that information and explaining what happened to this idea, what happened to that lead?
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, in a big story like this, I think loose ends do get caught tied up. The problem are the little stories where something may be reported and nobody's paying enough attention to bother to do the tying up. But that's certainly not the case here. I'm not sure. I haven't been watching every network the entire time this is happening, so I'm not sure whether or not. I suspect somebody has re-brought up that story, and my guess is, although I'm not sure, is that probably led to nothing, or we'd be. We'd be hearing more about it. Now, if that third arrest would have been reported and they would have given someone's name and shown a picture, then my guess would be that we would have that would have been followed up much more extensively.
Peter, great question. Thanks for the call. I wanted to ask each of you, since we have talked so much about who got what wrong in the coverage of the bombings in Boston, who got it right? What were some examples of really great coverage, be they through a news organization or people, individuals through social media? And I'll start with you, Adam Schweigert. What really struck you as really solid, good work?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of like local outlets, I think did like a great job. And I think NPR also they actually sent like a tweet Friday. That said, I'm actually going to hit pause right now and just wait a few minutes because there's way too much information out there, like too much like speculation. I want to wait until I actually have the facts like straight and can share something. I think that's great. So I think you know, NPR, I think New York Times also, they had large periods where they didn't post anything. They stopped, you know, processed information and then shared actually what they could. So I think those are the main, I think, national outlets. And then, like, local media, I think WBUR, I think, did a fantastic job. And it was TV station. It was, I think, WVCB, right, that also did a great job, I think, of sort of covering it.
Although we did get an email here from Christopher in Manchester. He said, despite the criticism that there were nuanced racist implications on the network, it looked to me, conversely, there was lots of conjecture on NPR that this was similar to Oklahoma City, Ruby Ridge, etc., right out of the gate. So a perspective there. Paul Farhi, I wanted to mention an interesting conversation that I had when I was manning the Twitter feed on Friday night for this organization. I put out something a little bit like the tweet that Adam mentioned from NPR where they said we're going to put a pause out. I put a note out saying we are hearing applause from the scene in Watertown and we don't know what that's about yet. We'll tell you when we confirm it. And I got a note back from a listener who said, geez, you guys are way behind the curve. I know you're trying to confirm, but you're taking way too long. And I thought that was interesting because you so often hear stick with the facts and don't get ahead of the story.
Well, that actually goes to the point I was going to make about who did a great job. I'll tell you who did a great job. Newspapers did a great job because they had the perspective of 24 hours or 12 hours or whatever it might be, where they could assemble all of this chaotic information into something coherent and cogent. Now, unfortunately, you receive your newspaper 12, 24 hours after events happen. Often that's way too late after the event itself. In this case, in some ways, it gave you great perspective on what had happened and what was useful to know, not what was extraneous or false, but mostly what was understood up to that point. And so it's a real argument for slow news rather than fast news. And newspapers can still do that, and they showed that in the past week.
And Bob Thompson, at the same time, I remember hearing lots of accolades being directed toward a reporter for NBC who had been covering counterterrorism and security issues, and I think he was getting a lot of kudos for his coverage, too.
Right, he was, and I think there was a lot of very good coverage. But I would echo what Paul said, not only for the newspapers, but this gets back to how you started the hour with that Slate article by Farhad Manjoo, which is that he said you should go clean your gutters, and then after the whole thing's over, read a couple of good newspaper accounts, and you'll be fine. I think the newspapers did a great job, and I would say television networks and cable networks have been doing 12 hours after the fact has been some pretty good reporting and some pretty good context and all of that. I suppose judging breaking news versus judging how this stuff actually gets covered journalistically with a, you know, when it's not actually happening are two entirely different things.
But at the same time, can we really, Adam Schweigert, tear ourselves away long enough to go clean the gutters when we know that there's something there? I mean, even if we know kind of on a head level that we shouldn't, that our heart is saying, I really want to see on Twitter, I really want to watch the screen anyway.
I think it depends on the story. I mean, I think if there is this sort of public interest, this factor, public safety factor, right, that I think if people, that like a lot of people get sucked in, especially if that's your city. Although, I mean, from like a national perspective, you know, there are, I think certainly times I sort of wish I had gone and, you know, and like not been online and just like read just a day after like account. I think if you actually you actually like read a good like morning like newspaper every day, you would have gotten, I think, like just as much information and actually far less misinformation. So I think there's absolutely, there's a lot of credence there. So I think it's, yeah, you sort of have to be willing to, I think, sometimes like pull yourself away.
And we're going to have to pull ourselves away because we're out of time for the hour. But I want to say a big thank you to each of you for being with us. Paul Fahrey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Paul Fahrey is media reporter for The Washington Post. Adam Schweigert, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
Adam Schweigert, Director of Technology with the Investigative News Network. And Bob Thompson, thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Bob Thompson is founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Brady Carlson. Tomorrow on The Exchange, checking in on the dropout rate. In 2009, Governor Lynch signed a law making it illegal to drop out of school before age 18. Last month, state officials touted a report ranking the state among those with the lowest dropout rates. But not all is rosy. In certain areas, the number is a lot higher, especially in Manchester. We'll look at what's working and what isn't for our dropout rate. Join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show is next at 10.